So I actually need to start this show with a disclaimer. During episode 109, in the introduction to episode 109, I said that scientists are no fun. I do not believe this. I regret saying this. Scientists are indeed very fun, including all the scientists that I know that listen to this show. Apparently, scientists just have no sense of humor. Welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 110 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Today's guest excites me greatly because, besides the fact that he is a writer of great renown, this man writes circles around me. And he does something that kind of interests me. If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you'll know that I kind of have a thing against lists. I find that they've pretty much taken over the internet in all sorts of capacity and a really gigantic waste of time and energy. However, this man's lists are something special because not only is there a massive amount of thought put into them, but they're so intricate and feature things like 42 things I love about shame that no one else talks about. And the man cobbles together word and image in such a way that it makes me think, well, maybe lists aren't so bad after all. As if his talent isn't enough, he is tonight braving a pretty nifty power outage that I'm sure has him sweltering in his apartment while I blather on with this intro. So I guess I should wrap it up. We are across a wire to California tonight, joined by the sometimes jovial, the usually classy, and the always intelligent brains behind And So It Begins. Please welcome Alex Withrow to the show. How are you, sir?
Good. I'm doing well. That was a very kind introduction. That was very nice for you to say.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm going to tell people I got a nice little unprompted email from you a week or two ago, and it just came on such a crappy day that I was like, you know, I got to get this guy on the show like soon. So I thank you for that email, and I thank you for being here tonight. And as I say, certainly among less than ideal conditions in Los Angeles. We will be talking about Volume 1 and Volume 2 of Nymphomaniac. We will not be flipping the record over to play the other side just because we want to give both these films their due, but we will be doing Come Talk to Me and, of course, Know Your Enemy. Before we get into any of that, I just want to give a couple things. First of all, we will set a few ground rules. We will be talking about both films in their complete form. This show is usually pretty spoiler free, but I really want to get all the way down to the end of both movies. So if you haven't seen either film, consider yourself warned. We're going to talk about them like right up until their bitter end. Speaking of that, though, we will only be dealing with one film at a time. So when we talk about Nymphomaniac Volume 1, we're not really going to be jumping ahead to Volume 2. We'll be staying on point. I'll be making sure that Alex respects the ground rules, so don't worry. What then, though, when we get to Volume 2, we may trip back to Volume 1 just because I can't really foresee a way that somebody would have seen Volume 2 without seeing Volume 1. So that's the structure of this show. It's a little bit off book than usual, but I'm sure that will be cool with you. So with all of that in mind, it is now time to learn more about Alex. Now we will know our enemy. All right, sir, you know how this goes. What was one of the first films you can remember seeing in a theater?
I can remember like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. So that's 91 and 92 when I would have been 5 and 6. But the first real like memorable experience was Jurassic Park in 93. So I grew up in a very, very small town. Closest theater was a crappy little two screener, two towns over. So my mom takes me Saturday, the weekend the movie comes out. And the line is literally, I mean, it's blocks and blocks long. And these towns that I grew up in and around were so small, people just had nothing to do. So they waited for like 4 hours to see Jurassic Park with their kids. There was no other option. I mean, there's nothing to do. And so that was my first real experience with that anticipation, that anxiousness of like waiting to see a movie and you're out there and it's this fun thing. And then the movie itself for a 6-year-old kid, it was terrifying and great and fantastic, and I still love it. So that's the first one that really sticks in my mind.
You know, I always think about Jurassic Park. A friend of the show, Simon Collum, I know it's one of his very, very favorite movies, and he brings it up like all the time. And it's a movie I think to myself, I wish I was younger when I saw it.
Sure.
Because
when I
saw it, I would have been 93. I would have been 15. And even if I even had been 10, I think that movie would have just like landed for me so much harder than it did at 15 years old. Like at 15 years old, it was cool. It was really cool. It was the movie, of course, that everybody saw that summer. But if I saw that in the theater at 10 years old, that probably would have just like changed my life.
Yeah. And that's such a fair point. I mean, I totally get, it's all about that context of like being a kid and it's exciting. So I think that makes sense what you're saying. Absolutely. Yeah.
If that was my first experience with a movie, that totally would have seared my brain into a deeper love of film. That's for sure. What's one of the last films you saw?
I'm going to sound like a psychopath when I say this. I watch Shame and Upstream Color about once a week, and I don't do it because I'm a masochist. I made a movie like a few months ago, and I'm editing it now. And those movies are such a source of inspiration that they just act as reminders, like reminders that you can break rules and reminders to trust my instincts. And so I watch them regularly. So that would be Shame.
Those are some interesting choices in that. Like, yeah. Even I don't even know word one about your film, but that informs me quite a bit about what you're after. Let's talk about Shame. Like, what are you drawing from it specifically?
That movie breaks, which I mentioned, that list that you mentioned, so many narrative rules throughout. Even the intro, how it's messing with time. And then there's this really brief fantasy that Michael Fassbender has of his coworker when they're in the office one day, and that's not anywhere else. So it's just these little editing devices that, because seemingly it's a very straightforward, it's like a week in the life of this guy, but he's still playing with the narrative system. So that's what my movie doesn't have the subject material of that movie, nor does it have Upstream Color, but it's kind of a reminder to trust your instincts, break the rules if you want. And also, I just like movies that don't spell a lot out. You have no idea in Shame really the story behind, like, him and his sister, for instance.
Right.
There's gonna be a lot of ambiguity in my movie, so I don't know, it's just something I'm drawn to.
Cool. Well, that gives me, you know, that certainly piques my curiosity. And the one thing, you know, not to harp too much, I should probably just link to this post in the show notes at this point. But the one thing I love that you talk about in that post is the way that Shame does so much without spelling it out for you, just in terms of what its actors do. So, for instance, where Michael Fassbender is standing on the subway platform at the beginning of the movie versus where he's standing on the subway platform at the end of the movie.
Exactly. Those are the things that it really is a very subtle film. I know a lot of people don't see it that way, but it's because it has, you know, the 3.5 minute long threesome scene. Fair enough. But it really is that the subtlety is there, and it's something that I find very inspiring.
Absolutely. Sure. All right, what's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
That's easy. Sex and the City 2, no question. No hesitation. Awful. It's an abomination. So,
why did you see that?
You know, this is around, at that time, I was actually like a paid film critic for a newspaper. Okay. So they paid me to see everything. And I went opening night, like just a total loser, sitting there in a theater by myself, like sold out theater. Oh, it was, that's my version of hell. That was hell.
Oh man. I see, you know, it's kind of funny because we sit here in a week where paid film critics have taken a bit of a massive hit in the coins. And as much as I think to myself, man, you know, as much as I would love to get paid for this, and how shameful it is that some of the best paid people are not being paid to do it anymore, I think about moments like that, and I think, you know, I'm okay. I'm all right choosing what I want to cover. What is a classic or essential that you have not yet seen?
That's kind of a tough one because I'm such a film addict. Like, so I thought about that one a lot too, and I realized there's a lot of these action or action comedies or just straight comedies from the 80s that have kind of passed me by that are probably right in your wheelhouse. Things like Big Trouble in Little China. Never seen that. Police Academy. I don't know, Porky's. Like, all those things have kind of, I've just made room for other things, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of crazy because, you know, this was something that came up quite a bit in the winter when we were talking about blind spots, and that, you know, the assumption out there is that blind spots are dictated by canon, whether it's, you know, a film 101 course or something like the BFI Sight and Sound list or Best Picture winners or whatever, but blind spots really and unseen classics or essentials are dictated by you. So, you know, for, you know, that you, what you're touching on here is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about, where somebody could be really, really well versed in film literacy, but there's just huge swaths of things that they just never got to, you know, not even out of disinterest, but just because there were other things that they were doing at the time. So no, I'm actually with you. There's a lot of, even though I was around for a lot of it, there's a lot of 80s like comedies and action movies that I'm only now just catching up on. Like I saw 48 Hours for the first time just a few months ago.
Same here.
Right?
On Netflix. So, yeah, same here.
I would suggest, though, of those ones you mentioned, I would suggest Big Trouble in Little China, just because that one is a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I keep hearing. So I definitely, this is going to motivate me to check that one out.
And all right, Mr. Filmmaker, last but not least, what is a film that for any reason you wish you had made?
Shame.
That's going to be coming up a lot this episode, I get the hunch.
Well, no, I will move on for those once we get into the other world of Lars von Trier.
Gotcha.
But no, I mean, those two are just, there are any number of films, but those are the two recently that have really, really had a very profound impact on me.
Well, yeah. Good. Yeah. No, very good. Very good answer. And let's put it this way. I can tell you with certainty, nobody's cited that answer before. Well, there we go. That's quite a bit about Alex and, you know, his love for Shame. We'll learn a bit more about you folks on the other side of this break. It's your chance to come talk to me right after this. Well, I don't know if you find folks got shy or if you are reserved on this topic or what, but I got far less answers to this feedback question than I thought I would get, especially since it's a pretty straightforward question. On episode 109, where Stevie Taylor joined me to talk about Noah, I asked, quite simply, what are some of the sexiest films that you've ever seen? I thought that this was something that was easy. Like, of all the crazy questions I ask, I thought that this was going to be one that I would have litanies of answers to, but not so much. I got answers from 2/3 of the Across the Universe podcast, the chick with accents. Sophia was the lone holdout. Sophia never answers me. I must have pissed off Sophia in a former life or something. But Nikhath Zara got us started. She's on Being Norma Jean. She said, sexiest movie ever is Sex, Lies, and Videotape. That is one hot movie, and James Spader, man, even with that hair, he was totally doing it for me. I think we're going to be talking about that later, because that's a film that I was thinking about a lot in the shadow of Nymphomaniac.
Yeah, good answer. I love Nick. I adore. So that wouldn't be something I would think. It's just a good answer. I didn't even think about that one.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, me too. Matt Kowalski, also from Across the Universe, she runs Lime Reviews and Strawberry Confessions, said, I keep coming back to The Dreamers. It's probably a bit disgusting in places, as it has semi-incestuous relationship going on, but hey, we live in a time of Game of Thrones, right? It stars three of the most attractive people in the world, and them imitating famous film scenes is the cherry on top. I just can't watch that movie without getting turned on. Was that too much information? No, that's fine, Matt. You're good. You're among friends. This is a safe place. Okay, you know, speaking of films we've never seen, I've never seen The Dreamers. Am I missing out?
It is perfect. I mean, it doesn't get me as inspired as it sounds like he gets her, which is fine. But no, it's very, you know, it's Bertolucci, so it's kind of like a modern day. It has the eroticism of Last Tango in Paris. I pushed a little further, in my opinion, but I mean, it's good. It's a warts little flick.
Okay, I'll push it up the queue somewhat. On Facebook, my friend Matthew Price said, "Little Shop of Horrors, 1986. Number one fantasy situation: platinum blonde, cheap clothes, dental equipment, monster, laugh at gas, doo-wop babes. I will never have the resources to create it at home." Thank you, Matt.
All right.
Dan Heaton actually stole one of my answers. I was kind of grumpy about this because this is kind of my go-to for my own question. But Dan Heaton said, Out of Sight. Two charming, attractive people talking about movies and having a lot more in common than just being cops and robbers. That for me has been the sexiest movie for quite some time. And I don't really particularly like Jennifer Lopez. I just kind of find that her attitude that she conveys is just a little bit much, but in that movie, she is just perfect. And in my, you know how, like, you know, you've got your Tyler Durden version of yourself.
Sure.
My Tyler Durden version of myself is George Clooney. In my ideal mind's eye, I am George Clooney rocking a suit.
That's awesome.
So yeah, that movie is just sexy all around. So thanks for stealing my answer, Dan.
And I would go out on a limb and say that movie might contain the sexiest non-sex scene ever, because that thing in the hotel room is just on fire.
The bit in the bar that then trickles up to the hotel room.
Exactly, and cutting back and forth, and he's stopping, stop mode. Oh, it's just great. It's great.
Yeah, I might have to watch that when we're done recording.
Yeah.
My friend Andrew Robinson from G-Man Reviews in Jamaica said, take this waltz, and I need to give him props for that, because that movie makes a damn good job of making my hometown of Toronto look really sexy. I live here in that place. This place is not that sexy. Kate Bradford from Kate Has a Blog, and Kate has a podcast, which I appeared on the first two episodes of. Go listen to that. She said Basic Instinct, Dirty Dancing, and for some strange reason, Disturbia. She says she was like 16 years old when that came out, so it counts.
Whatever works for you. I mean, go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Finally, two answers from Twitter. Shane at Film Actually said Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Yeah, that movie is about seven kinds of hot. And Jake Cole, who tweets as Not Just Movies, said Only Lovers Left Alive, and I swear to God, I am the only person in the world who has not seen this movie yet. It feels like the whole damn internet has seen this Jarmusch movie already, and I'm still sitting here waiting.
Yeah, I caught it a few days ago.
You've seen it too, son of a bitch!
I have, gotta say.
Oh, man.
Yep.
Well, those are some very, very sexy movies, people. Good job. I'm, you know, definitely hit the nail on the head. What do you got? Okay. Lord help you if you say shame to this.
No, come
okay,
on. I'm, like I said, I'm not a masochist.
Gotcha. Okay. What do you got? What are some of your sexiest movies?
The sexiest I would have to say is Y Tu Mama Tambien.
I hadn't thought of that one. Shit.
What he did with that, it's so minimalist and experimental, and I really like that one. Very raw. Bound with Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly.
I kind of feel like that's the typical guy answer, though.
Well, sure. I had one of those. I have three, and that was my typical guy answer.
That's your typical guy answer. Okay.
And then Lawrence Kasdan's Body Heat with William Hurt.
Kathleen Turner?
Yeah.
Do you know I've never seen that?
It gets pretty raw, man, let me tell you.
Okay. That's one of those 80s ones that was always like, I remember always going over to like a friend's place, and like his parents had a copy of that, like up a little bit higher on the shelf.
Sure.
So it was always taunting me. I need to see that one. And it's kind of noirish, isn't it?
It is. It's very noir, and it's like sweaty, and Mickey Rourke, it might be what it's like his first movie. He's just great. It's a small role, but it's actually a really good movie, but it's also really sexy. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'll definitely have to check that out. Well, I've got three of my own. One of them was inspired by the last Toronto Pub Night, and I wish I could give credit to who brought it up, but being Pub Night, I was too drunk to remember. apologies in advance, but the guy answer and the typical answer is the modern answer, is Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the one with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Specifically the scene where they're kicking the crap out of each other.
Right.
You know,
right.
I do quite enjoy Angelina Jolie looking down at him and saying, who's your daddy now? Like that, like there are a few things in film as hot as that moment. But some older answers as well that I thought about this week. One of them is Bonnie and Clyde with Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty, both really young. And the director in that movie, I believe it's Arthur Penn.
Yep.
He when he went to kind of stitch it all together and edit it, he took some longer takes where the actors were a lot less aware, and just kind of like getting into their scene and getting out of their scene. So you'll see stuff like Warren Beatty has got a match in between his teeth and he's kind of playing with it, like just completely subconsciously. Or Faye Dunaway is drinking a bottle of Coke, but she's drinking it somewhat suggestively, but that's not something that she's obviously doing deliberate. It's just something like she's drinking a bottle of Coke really, really well. So that's one. And of course, just, you know, they both look just hot as hell in that movie, even though the funny thing is, of course, that there's no actual sexual charge to Bonnie and Clyde.
Right. Exactly. Because in the movie, he's impotent, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, you know, it all comes out through their bank robbing, which is kind of sexy for its own reason. And then the last one I thought about was one that somebody brought up on a podcast, and I can't remember when. I'm doing horribly with citing my references today. I do apologize to everybody. Cool Hand Luke.
Because, oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the South. It's hot. You got dudes with their shirts off. You've got friggin' Paul Newman looking all Paul Newman. You know, he's got the eyes going on and everything, and he's you know, it's again kind of like the George Clooney in my mind's eye. I am Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke.
That's not a bad guy to beat.
No, not at all. So yeah. those were my answers, and I'm sure I'm forgetting some. But thanks everybody for getting a little bit dirty on episode 110. That leads us to the new slang for this episode. Once again, we are going to be going spoiler heavy, and we are going to be talking about these films as complete pieces, starting right after this with Nymphomaniac Volume 1. Come on back.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about sex.
Nymphomaniac Volume 1 was written and directed by Lars von Trier. It stars Charlotte Gainsbourg, Stellan Skarsgård, Stacey Martin, Shia LaBeouf, Christian Slater, Uma Thurman, and Connie Nielsen. It is the story of Jo, that's Charlotte Gainsbourg, who we first meet crumpled in a heap in a back alley in some nameless European town. She's gathered and taken in by Seligman, who asks how she got there. And it turns out that's a long story, mostly driven by Joe's more than active than most sexual proclivities. In this half of her story, we learn how she first became sexually aware as a child, how she became especially sexually active as a teenager, and how much of her attention and affection was focused on a young man named Jerome. That's LaBeouf. Then we also learn how all of this was affected, of course, by her relationship with her father. Much of what you've heard is true. There are an unusually high amount of sexual acts that take place within this film, all described in an almost clinical fashion. There's full frontal of both sexes and more actual depiction than you count on seeing anywhere other than your laptop screen. So, pop quiz, hotshot. Quite simply, is this the dirtiest movie you've ever seen?
No. No.
Okay.
And I'm talking real movie. I'm not talking like, as you just said, laptop at 2 a.m. or whatever. No, it wasn't.
Okay, that's interesting, because you know what? Like, I saw this. Actually, that's the other thing we should kind of put there right on the table. How did you experience Nymphomaniac? Because this film famously opened up as one 5-hour opus, which was then, you know, you can't release a 5-hour film these days, even in an art house, which was then split up into two parts. And while both parts are getting screenings here and there, you know, they're not playing in a lot of places. It's actually on demand right now. So if people haven't seen it, I would suggest going and checking wherever you would watch a movie on demand, including, I think, iTunes, and seeing if you can track down Nymphomaniac. But how did you see these movies? Did you watch them separately? Did you watch them on separate nights, on like a week apart, on one night? How did you do them?
That's actually good, because that's going to play into my discussion for Volume 2. But for now, I watched them both at home, on TV, on demand. But they were released something like 3.5 weeks apart. So that's how I watched both of them. It was like I watched them the day or the day after they came out. But three and a half weeks apart.
Okay. And that's interesting, because for me, I decided that I wanted to pull the Band-Aid off in one fell swoop. And I watched them in a theater. We have the Lightbox here in Toronto is playing both. And I watched them on one night. So I went after, yeah. I went after supper time. I went for volume one. There was a nice little 30-minute break, and then I went back into the theater and caught part two. So part of me thinks that that actually informed my entire take of this movie, not just seeing it in the theater, but sitting through the whole thing basically in one long go.
My biggest reaction was that I assumed he was going to push it a lot farther than did. And that was just my biggest thing. I was like, this isn't so bad. Like, oh yeah, there's the montage of all the dicks. Okay. Here we go. Now we're getting into it. Like, but it never really ventured into, and this is speaking strictly for volume one, it never got to be really too much for me. I'm not very sensitive about this kind of stuff. I didn't have a problem with the sexuality in it, or I didn't think he crossed the line. There were far, when you said, what was the question you asked me, the dirtiest movie?
I
thought there are scenes in Antichrist that are far more gruesome and just completely messed up than what happened in volume one.
So the funny thing is, actually, I've actually never seen Antichrist, and I kind of want to push that up the queue a little bit, because now it's the only film of the Depression trilogy that I've never seen, with the two Nymphomaniac films, which, again, really is one movie, Antichrist and Melancholia. It's the only one of the three I've never seen, so I kind of feel like I should really get to that now. To answer my own question, it's kind of crazy, because we're in a strange time where the sorts of things that we see in volume one don't seem that dirty. But in reality, for like an art film, this is pushing it.
No, sure. Like, I think in the world of film, it definitely pushed the limits. I mean, in terms of my sensibilities, not so much. But yeah, like, he's definitely going for it and no looking back. So yeah, I fully agree with that.
I gather you dug it.
I liked volume one very much. Yeah, I did.
I was going to say, otherwise I've brought you on for the wrong show.
No, I liked it.
I got to
admit,
I kind of did want to bring on somebody who hated this movie, because I can only imagine the arguments that this film is causing amongst people.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got our hero with this movie. We've got Charlotte Gainsbourg, again, who has now been in all three chapters of this Depression trilogy. And her character, who... I don't think that it's an accident that her name is non-distinct and unisex. And we listen to her telling these stories, and we watch both her and Stacey Martin playing the same character. And first of all, I think that it was really cool that they both got the spirit of this character very similar. Sometimes when you get two actors trying to play the same character, they kind of miss.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that they got it really well. And the thing that I found kind of crazy going through volume one is, by and large, she seems to be getting everything from sex except joy.
That's kind of what the movie was about for me, volume one. Yeah,
which, you know, that's, now I'm sure that was what Seligman, our you know, us in the movie, the guy who's sitting there listening, I would imagine that was what was throwing him, was because he was listening to all these stories. If I was telling a story about having three separate lovers who were doing three separate things for me, I wager that I would have a smile on my face for some part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we don't watch her as she's telling it, we watch the footage of her with these men. She's not really conveying any sense of actual happiness or satisfaction that she was taking out of it. She says, like, you put the three together and then it made for a complete. And she's getting enough, because, you know, Lord knows she's doing it. And it's not like she's the one thing we got to say for this movie that it actually doesn't touch, and I'm kind of surprised, is there's no prostitution.
Right.
You know, like, she's doing this because she wants to.
I found that to be the most compelling part of the movie. I found her indifference extremely captivating, because it's something that we don't see too often. She was telling it, like, with the simplicity and the apathy of how you take out the garbage on Tuesday night. It was no, like, there was no emotion to it. And from both ends, from both actresses, because like you said, I thought the crossover between them was very, very good. I thought Stacey Martin and Gainsbourg both did a great job. So that's what I really dug about it. I love that there was no pity party, feel, you know, woe is me. there was no denial. It seemed from a very early age, from that even that bathtub scene when they're on the floor swimming around in the bathroom, that this was who she was. There was no trying to deny it, and it was, she just accepted it right away. And it was there was no joy. There was a routineness to it that I found very interesting, just from like a psychological perspective. I just think it's fascinating.
Well, even right down to the way that she goes to Jerome to take her virginity, right? Like, you hear about stories about people losing their virginity, and they're either truly pathetic or they're trumped up. But right. Hers, like, she literally walks into the guy's house and says, you know, will you take my virginity? I believe she actually says those words.
And it sounds like she's asking, hey, can you loan me $5? Because I got to, like, go catch the bus.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't. Yeah, I love that. And, oh, God, I love that scene. That scene is so Von Trier with the large numerical typeface, and, oh, my God.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, this movie, like many other Von Trier movies, it plays around with things like the graphics on the screen. It does things like, you know, the angle of the car trying to get into the parallel parking spot, and the the number of strokes that Jerome actually gives to Joe, both vaginally and anally, in this mathematical equation. And it just fills the friggin' screen with this equation. You were cool with all that, or did that ever seem like too much?
I think let me go out on a limb here. Just bear with me. I think Lars von Trier is actually a very, very funny man. I think he has a very twisted, very sick sense of humor that is not to be understood by all. But I do think in a lot of his movies, maybe not Antichrist, because that's on a whole nother level. Just wait till you watch that. Goody. Oh my God. But his movies he injects humor in them, not always through dialogue, but just because then it's funny. Okay, so imagine that scene without that large typeface. It'd be like, I don't know, it'd be kind of gruesome. Yeah, bleak. But then now you're laughing, and it's funny. It's like, oh, this is so matter of fact for her. Like, I mean, how old was she when she lost her virginity? And all these years later, she remembers the amount of pumps? Like, who remembers that? It's just, I found it so funny. And like, so I dug it. Yeah, I dug it.
Well, speaking of that humor, I want to jump ahead a little bit, because there's a sequence. The film is broken into chapters. There's five chapters, which she's telling her life story, and she finds that the best way that she can do it is to kind of group things together into chapters. And one of the chapters, I believe it's the third one, is called Mrs. H, where she's talking about how at this point she's in her her early 20s. She's living on her own. She's sexually insatiable, where she's just got like a never-ending line of guys who she can't even keep them straight. And one of them is a married man. And she thinks that she's gonna, you know, she's done with this married man, or just his number's up. She's not even really done with any of these guys. She only knows that she can only juggle so many of them at any one time. So she's got this weird little system that she's playing out with dice, which dictates how she reacts to these people, these men emotionally. So this guy's number comes up, and she wants to break it off with him. And she figures it's really easy because he's a married man, and all she has to say is, well, I can't have you. Well, of course, what do you do to anybody to make them want you more than say you can't have them? And he comes right back and says, well, I just left my wife. I left my wife so that I can be with you. And I don't even think he's finished saying the damn words. Then we realize that his wife is actually outside. His wife, Mrs. H, played by Uma Thurman. And I swear to God, if I see anything funnier than the scene of Mrs. H confronting her husband's mistress with her three sons in tow, if I see anything funnier than that this year, I'll eat my words. One of the most absurd and amazingly funny things I've ever seen,
and will go down as one, if not the like greatest sequence of Lars von Trier's career. Just a bravado sequence, and absurd is the key word. Because he knows, whether or not you like him, like, this director, this dude knows what he's doing. And it was just so over the top. And Uma Thurman, I mean, how she was so committed to it. She was just totally going for it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved that sequence.
Well, she's got to, like, she's basically telling jokes with a straight face.
Yeah, she's playing it totally straight.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She knows how absurd that everything is. And anybody else would have, like, probably turned that into something farcical and turned it into something really, really hammy. But but she's being very proper and very sincere about it and saying, like, can I take the children to see the whoring bed? I lost it. I heard her say that, and I hadn't actually seen anything of this movie really going in except for, like, one scene on the train. And I lost my mind watching that scene. It was insane.
No, it was great. I mean, by far the highlight of both volumes for me.
And certainly, you know, when you talk about the twisted humor and the unexpected humor, that's certainly where it's at.
Oh yeah, that was
now,
great.
You're a lot smarter than me. So
oh come on!
I'm hoping you could explain something to me, because the one thing, thinking back on it, that I'm having a little bit of trouble reconciling is where her relationship with her father plays into all of this. Like, there's an obvious parallel in that when her father gets sick, that she feels a measure of guilt and shame, that she deals with her stress and her grief through sex. I get that, but I'm just trying to kind of understand why we spent so much time with her relationship with her dad and her father explaining, you know, his fascination with trees and that kind of thing. Can you kind of, like, fill me in a little bit here on what I'm not quite bright enough to catch?
Well, I'm almost right where you are. I mean, that was the weakest stuff in the film for me, because I thought it was going to come out, and how dare I think it would be this obvious, that they had something going on, whether he was abusing her or she had fallen in love with him. I assumed we were going to take a turn like that, but it never went there. And I don't think that ever happened to those characters. It was just, man, I don't really know. Because I think they had a very, very deep human connection. Perhaps the only one she's had really in her life, maybe until she meets Jerome later, but not even.
No.
I just thought they really had this very strong connection, and that his loss was this, it was like an emotional loss that she was feeling for the first time maybe ever. So she deals with it sexually, like she deals with everything sexually. But of the five chapters of volume one, that one wasn't really working for me.
Well, it worked for me in the way that she deals with her grief with sex. Like, she's got one of the shots in these movies, and there are a lot of glorious shots in these movies, but one of the shots in these movies that will stick with me for a long, long time is her face when she's hitting it on a gurney. Is she in the morgue?
Yeah, she's in the morgue with that guy. Just to be clear, those were my favorite, and the sex scenes I appreciated the most in the volume. So aside from those, I thought that, I think it was called Delirium, chapter, it just went a little too long. But no, I mean, yeah, she did tap into something. It was very carnal, and it's in a morgue, and she seemed to kind of being, I don't know if enjoying it. She was getting to another level sexually.
Well, actually, that's the thing. Like, I looked at her expression, and hey, let's bring up shame again. I saw that same expression that's on Michael Fassbender's face late in that movie, where there's a real sadness and grief and self-loathing.
Mid-coitus. Right. So it's not like enjoyment was the wrong word, but we haven't really seen that from her yet either. So there's this whole new level of satisfaction, even though it's very bad satisfaction. I'm at a loss for words. There's just, she hit a new sexual peak there. Yeah. It wasn't a good one, but
so I guess like that, that's,
it was very interesting.
Maybe that's the thing to take away from it, is here is somebody who, like, probably the only character in the whole movie who she loved on a non-sexual level. Cause, like, even her mother, she mentions that her mother is very remote.
Right.
And by the time her father passes, her mother is completely out of the picture. So here's the only person who she cared about on a non-sexual level and shared a deep closeness with. And when he's going, the only thing that she can think of, like, first of all, she feels some genuine loss. Probably the only time she'll feel that in two movies. And the only way that she can deal with it is with more sex.
That's all I got from it. I struggle to find anything deeper than that. I can't really tell you all the leaf stuff. I don't know what, you know, on the trees, and I thought there was a bit too much of that, but I thought it was just her experiencing loss for the first and possibly only time in her life. I think the metaphors, the very extended metaphors, the fly fishing, Fibonacci sequence,
right,
the religious parallels, those have been getting, in the reviews I've read, a lot of flack.
Really?
And a few of the reviews I've read, and I just wanted to comment on those briefly to say, I've never seen that in any other film, like, remotely. I'm not sure. At some points, it was hanging on by kind of a thin thread, and they were reaching a little bit. But I really enjoyed that, because it was something new, it was totally bizarre, and it was totally Von Trierian. So, well, those are just my two cents on that.
You know what it kind of makes me think of is somebody who is talking about a high sexual activity and nymphomania and their whole outlook on life in this capacity. I kind of feel like you are going to have to lean on metaphor a lot, because otherwise the person you're talking to, and then by extension us in the audience, we're not going to get it. Like, we're going to, as it is, we're going to sit back and judge this woman. So if we don't get some of these metaphors to understand why she's doing what she's doing, or even how she's doing what she's doing, I think more how than why, then I think that we're not going to go for the bait to kind of take the fishing metaphor one step further.
Yeah, and I thought, I mean, that's great insight. I agree with all that, absolutely.
So we end volume one with this really strange plot point that after all of this intense sexual track record that Joe has, that all of a sudden her body has kind of given out on her, that she's getting no sensation anymore. Like, did that land for you, or did that kind of seem like it was forced?
No, I loved it.
You know what the crazy thing is about it too, is that she delivers the line and then fade out. It's not like, it doesn't even linger on it. That's just the last moment of this volume.
It was very funny to me too. Like, again,
really?
I started chuckling, and I'm like, this guy is just such a sick son of a bitch. Like, the you know, Von Trier.
The thing that I thought about when that was the ending note is, I thought, here's something that we're driving home the point at this stage of, here's somebody who is just not taking any actual satisfaction out of sex, and we're going to take even the physical satisfaction out for her, you know, because she's not enjoying it the way that most people enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're just about done talking about volume one, but, and we're not going to rate each individual movie. We're going to rate them together, because I really believe that it was intended as one film. So we're going to treat it as one film. We're going to get a rating at the end. And we'll, you know, maybe we'll break it up. I don't know. We'll see how I feel in 20 minutes. But we will do the souvenir for each side. So, Alex, if you had to choose a souvenir from volume one, something either tangible or intangible that you could keep from this movie and have if you wanted, and I'm laughing at the absurdity of that when we're talking about a movie as sexually charged as this, what would be your souvenir from Nymphomaniac volume one?
It would be the notion of fear. Because I mentioned this in my volume one review, that's the thing that excites me most about Von Trier's films, is that I'm so afraid to begin them because I have no idea what I'm getting myself into. That's why I see his movies, because I'm so excited and afraid and nervous of where it's going. So it would just be to take away that notion of filmmakers still can surprise us. For better or worse, there are movies out there that can present stuff that we haven't seen before. So. Yeah.
Nice.
That would be a somewhat better answer, I think.
Yeah, and we do spend quite a bit of this movie waiting for something to go drastically, drastically wrong. My souvenir is something that we didn't actually touch on. My souvenir would be the opening of this movie, which is a pitch black screen where we're forced to listen. And we're just hearing the sounds that we're going to see when the camera finally does turn on. But we just listen. We just listen to this rain falling and this water running, and I think it's the key to the whole damn movie. I think this movie desperately wants us to listen, and it has to spell it out by making us listen in the opening. And if we forget that, going forward, and it's really easy to forget it because Lord knows what we see is way more interesting than what we're hearing sometimes. It's a really great touch by von Trier. It seems really, really arty and high concept, but I really, really dug it. And not just that, but I just loved the sound of this movie, especially in that opening. Well, there we go. That's volume one. That's a lot of volume one. Come on back right after this. We are going to go just as far into volume two right after this break. So this brings us to Nymphomaniac Volume 2, once again written and directed by Lars von Trier. Once again, it stars Charlotte Gainsbourg, Stellan Skarsgård, Stacey Martin, Shia LaBeouf, and this time we add in Jamie Bell, Willem Dafoe, and Mia Goth. Volume 2 picks up immediately after Volume 1's conclusion, with Jo continuing her recount of sexual history to Seligman. By this point in the story, she's lost sensation in her genitalia and isn't getting the pleasure out of sex she once did. Because of this, her relationship with Jerome is strained, and he suggests, as one does, she look for outside help. This outside help leads her down a dark path of anonymous hookups and forays into bondage before our heroine ultimately confronts her attitude towards sex head on. For many reasons, Volume 2 feels heavier and drearier than Volume 1. Perhaps it's the fact that Jo has to confront her demons. Perhaps it's because she has to begin using her sexuality as a weapon. Perhaps it's her foray into being a submissive in ways that one doesn't usually see on the big screen to this extent. Whatever the reason, Volume 2 dispenses with all of the airiness and smartassery of Volume 1, and in its place puts dysfunction, self-doubt, and guilt. So, pop quiz hotshot, after everything we saw in Volume 1, was this what you expected out of Volume 2?
Okay, what I said for Volume 1 was it didn't...
You said it wasn't right. The dirtiest movie you ever saw.
Right, and then Volume 2 took it so much farther than I was anticipating, based on Volume 1. It just really, really pushed it to... I guess I'll just start by saying this one didn't do it for me as much as the first volume, so that's...
Okay.
It's just interesting, but... No, I guess I was expecting kind of similar stuff, but then it went to this whole dark underbelly of this disease, and it was something else.
I dug them both in equal measure. If I had to watch them split in two separate sittings, I really think that I would have come away. I was going to say enjoying, but I don't really think this is the kind of movie that maybe you do. I don't think this is the kind of movie that one enjoys, but I think I would have appreciated them in equal measure. And if I was to rate them, if I had to rate them separately, I probably would rate them the same. What I think surprised me the most is that twisted humor that we were talking about in Volume 1 is gone by the time we get to Volume 2. Like, we are definitely a few turns down the spiral at this point and getting into some really, really dark places.
Yeah, absolutely. Which was one of my, just one of the things I didn't appreciate about it that much. You know, actually, I don't know if we're jumping ahead here, but I ended my review for Volume 2 by saying I think I would have appreciated this one more had I seen them back to back, like you did.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting that I'm glad we viewed them in different ways, because I don't know if it was the 3.5 weeks between that. I don't know. Or maybe it was just I didn't really like it as much. It was just the lack of humor was off-putting.
Let me put this to you, because this for a brief shining moment, this was actually on the table. What would you have thought if we had really monkeyed with the narrative and you'd watched Volume 2 before Volume 1?
Oh, is that something he wanted to do?
No, absolutely not. It was something. Let me tell this story, because I don't know how many people have heard this story. So I went to watch Volume 1 and Volume 2 together, and I decided I was going to go out and do this on a Wednesday night. And through a weird little fluke occurrence, the theater that I was going to go see it had canceled the late show of Volume 2, but not publicized it until very late in the day. So I had gone there and for nothing. When I, you know, I said, I'm going to watch them in one day. So I'm coming back tomorrow. Like, I'm not going to watch one and then come back. But as I left, as I got a few subway stops away from the theater, it occurred to me that they hadn't canceled the early show of Volume 2. So I could have gotten an early ticket for Volume 2 and a late ticket for Volume 1 and just watched them out of order.
I don't think that would have worked. I think that you would have had a lot of context that I think you would have spent a lot of Volume 2 if you saw it first, trying to catch up. Like, who's this Jerome guy? Like, what is the deal here? I mean, if it was played entirely backwards, like Memento, Versible style, something like that, then maybe, but I don't know. I don't think that would have worked too well.
Well, because for me, the way that I thought about it was not to jump too far ahead, because we'll get there, but I thought about the end of Volume 2 and the end of Volume 1 and how that would have been just radically different hearing them in the other order.
That's true. It would have been.
That's what draws me in and thinking, I kind of wish I did it. In the end, I'm happy I waited the day. But it made me think about that. In this volume now, we think about we're starting to deal with the consequences. We're starting to deal with the way her sexual appetite affects her relationships. Specifically, the family that she leaves. Like, by this point, she's got a daughter with Jerome. And her sexual appetite has her doing some things that a lot of people would really be taken aback by. And I think that was one of that was kind of why we're both so taken aback by where this chapter goes, is the way it finally starts to deal with the consequence of her relationships, which had largely been left untouched. The one thing that the movie really, really, it harps on, because it mentions it out loud, the way that the decisions of Joe really seem to take us aback. Specifically, like I said, the way it affects her family. But it probably wouldn't take us aback if she were a man.
Great point. I wanted to make that point as well. I think it's very hard to convey that. I think we live in a culture, in a society, where if a guy is doing some of the things that she's doing, they are cheered for it. Like, oh, yeah, good job, man. Like, it's no big deal.
I think it takes pitied.
Or they're pitied, right. I think it takes a very specific movie like Shame, I got there. I knew I was going to get there.
It's going to be a drinking game.
To convey that, to bring that across from a male perspective. But when you add a female to it, I think women are far more interesting and complex than men anyway, especially in my own like filmmaking. I love to write female characters. So I mean, the movie wouldn't have worked if it was a man. There's no way.
Well, I feel like, you know, like I feel like if nothing else, I feel like she's really, really, she's really direct about what she, like, first of all, in the beginning, going back to Volume 1, she's really direct about what each man is doing for her. You know, like, she's not just looking for dick because she's bored. She's looking for specific guys because they fulfill various gaps in her psyche.
And like, it goes back to that whole apathy or indifference. It's very off-putting. Like, it's jarring to see a woman talk about sex this way, basically. And I mean, we don't see it enough in movies. It doesn't. And I found that kind of refreshing, because I'm like, okay, this is cool. This is something we haven't seen. But you're right. There's no, she's describing like the need that they give her. There's no, I don't know, bragging or no enjoyment or anything.
And that's the thing. Like, I don't see a guy doing that. Like, I don't see a guy going to one woman because she's nurturing and another woman because she's domineering and another woman because she's got endurance or whatever. Like, I think that it's a really, really fascinating part of this movie that there, you know, that the woman is the nymphomaniac and she has to deal with, here's this word again, with the shame and the judgment and everything that comes with it that wouldn't come with it if she were a guy.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think it's a great point.
One of the crazy things that I thought about with this as well is this movie is not just there to entertain us and let us judge this sexual addict. This movie is actually out to judge us, because at one point or another, Joe kind of she calls out Seligman for how he's listening. And it might even be back in volume one. She basically calls out that he's listening and he's waiting to make his next analogy. But what that got me thinking of is we're listening and we're hanging on her every word. We're watching these trysts and we're getting off on it. You know, like, you ever get those people who are like, they're either like a neighbor or a coworker of somebody who's having an affair?
Sure.
Okay. And, you know, hearing about the affair is kind of doing something for them because they know that they'd never have the stones to actually have an affair for themselves.
Yeah, it's the whole living vicariously
exactly,
through them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This movie calls us out on that. This movie completely calls us out that we are judging this woman and we are basically calling her every name in the book. And she isn't even herself. Like, she, you know, she's like, I am a nymphomaniac. And this self-help group that she goes to is like, no, you're an addict. You're a sexual addict. She's like, no, I am this.
Yeah. But, and I'm filthy and disgusting. Yeah.
And some part of us likes that about her. And I kind of feel like that's one of the things that this movie does really, really well is there is a late chapter called The Mirror. And at one point or another in this movie, it holds up the mirror at us and says, you know, you're listening. And you know you wouldn't do this because your brain is working in a different way, but you're still getting off on listening to all this.
I mean, that's another really good point. It really does say a lot about us. And it was very obvious that this Stellan Skarsgård character, as you said, was us. I mean, you know, he's the audience, but no, you're right. I actually didn't think about it like that, but it's a very interesting thought. So now in my head, I mean, the big thing here is that the torture, the back room whip and coins and gloves. And I guess what I wanted to say is I think volume two went to a place of consequence that needs and deserves to be explored within this, the context and the frame of this story. That's not something that should be ignored. It shouldn't be, oh yeah, you know, being an nymphomaniac is so much, it's so easy and guilt-free. So I like that it went to a darker place, but I just got tired of it. I was like, all right, I get it. Like, I get what's going on here. This is gruesome. I found it a little repetitive, but that Jamie Bell character, I loved him. Like, I loved that we didn't know a lot about him. It goes back to my whole, I really enjoy ambiguity. And I mean, I want to know who that guy is. Like, how was that guy raised? What the hell has that guy been through? So I found what he did with it in a minimalist way very compelling. Well, so I like that.
And his whole setup is really fascinating because I kind of feel like where that whole area of sexuality is at is going through this kind of 50 Shades of Grey renaissance. Mm-hmm. And that everybody has in their brain that, you know, that a guy in that position is, you know, is somebody who would be dominating just in stature and in speech and in presence. But, like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, she's taller than him.
Yeah, I mean, that was very good casting, because not only is she taller, I mean, he's a young guy. He's young, and he doesn't...
He's unassuming.
He's very.
He's dressed in this gray sweatshirt that looks like it's something you could pick up for $4 at Target. He's in this apartment that looks like a complete dive in a room that's somewhere above a maintenance room or a janitor's office, and yet this is what's taking place. Like, there's this complete disconnect by the sexiness of it that's being sold in bookstores right now and what we're actually watching and what is actually doing something for Joe. Because let us not pussyfoot around this, pardon the pun, this is doing things for her.
Yeah, I mean, it like gets certain. Her... Yeah, it gets her back to life, and I mean, in no uncertain terms, it really. But the whole unassuming thing, just, I love the way he didn't look them in the eye. You know, he always had his head down, and it was, I mean, I just love that, the no eye contact thing. But no, yeah, it was very, it was working for her. That's like what she thought she needed, and I mean, I would just love to know how she found that guy. I liked the whole setup of it, but the repetitiveness, like I don't know. I was just like, okay, I get it. I don't know. It was just a bit much for me.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to guess that when he says that he's going to give her 40 lashes and starts counting, that you probably sat there and said, dear God, don't tell me I have to watch all 40.
I assumed, I mean, it's this whole notion of fear. Like, you don't know what the hell Von Trier is going to do, where he's going to go. So I thought, had he shown all 40, I wouldn't have been surprised. I would have been like, all right, here we go. Bring it on, man. Yeah. I'm already sitting here.
Yeah. I've been here for 3 hours now, mm-hmm. man. Yeah, that's the thing. By the time we got to that, I'd been sitting in the same spot basically for 3 hours.
Right.
So, yeah, that was with nowhere to go. I don't know. Like that part, it didn't bother me. I was more in like just engaged by the really, really griminess of it. Like there was really nothing sexy about it, unless this is something that does something for you, in which case I'm sure there was something sexy about it. But it took all of that sophistication and elegance that as I said, that is being sold in this kind of dynamic. And it still, it didn't even, you know what the crazy thing is? It didn't even really throw it into the kind of thing we talked about earlier that you'll see on your laptop where it goes really crazy, where things like look like they're in dungeons and people are wearing leather and there's friggin' pommel horses and that kind of crap. As I said, it was so unassuming that it completely arrested me.
Yeah. It never ventured into like snuff, right?
No.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It never got to that point, thankfully. Like I'm right there with you. Like I love the setup of it. I love the way it looked and all that. It was just, it kept doing it, and I don't know. But maybe it was because I had been through 3 hours of it, and I'm like, all right, I'm ready to move on. I don't know. But yeah. it was still oddly compelling. Like I didn't hate it or anything. I didn't hate the movie or that sequence. It was just, I got it after a while.
Were you down with the whole chapter about the mirror, like where she has to, one, where she has to confront who she is, and two, what she decides to do with that? Like, did that, because I think that that's kind of a key to this movie. Mirror was the one where she basically goes into group therapy. It's the one where she has to get rid of all of the reminders. She like papers over her windows and she packs up her phone and she, you know, basically like paints over her own mirrors. Mm-hmm. And she has to confront herself. The group wants to say that she's a sexual addict. She says nymphomaniac, and she has to decide basically if she's okay with this.
That, just breaking the chapters down, that was my favorite chapter of volume two.
Really?
I really liked that. I liked the whole, it was very introspective in a way. And I, again, that was probably the only time in volume two where there was a little humor, because when you see her taping foam on the corners of all her furniture, I mean, that's funny. That's like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was, but then she was just, it was just interesting and to see her explore another dynamic of her personality, which was now one of this kind of denial and taking all of this away, which we hadn't seen her do yet.
Yeah, it's, guess what movie we're about to bring up again?
Here we go. Let's do it.
It was like the moment in Shame where we watch him go through the knee-jerk reaction in a flurry of packing up all his porn and all of his magazines and videos and hard drives and, like, you know, in one of the most, like, fastest, I got to get all this out of here moments. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like with her it was far more reaching. Like, with Fassbender's character in Shame, it's all the stuff that's designed to titillate. Meanwhile, she's wrapping foam over doorknobs.
Right.
Because, you know, that's how far her condition has taken her.
Mm-hmm. She's got it bad already.
She does.
She's so, in bad shape.
Yeah. In a rare thing for this podcast, I want to jump to the very end of this movie.
Okay.
Because I believe that a person's opinion of the end will shape their opinion of, one, the whole film, two, the whole pair. So, you know, after we get all these confessions and all these recounts, and after she seems to have come even more at peace with who she is than she did in the mirror, you know, we Seligman basically tucks her in and he leaves the room and there's a sun rising and everything. I don't know why I even thought about this in a Von Trier movie, but everything looks like it's going to be okay. And then the man comes back into the room because a person who has confessed to being asexual after listening for 4 hours or longer in movie time of sexual stories, all of a sudden he's decided that he wants to give it a go, and a woman who is sexually liberated as Joe is going to be his ticket. And what we see, and I'm sure, as I said, if you've come this far, you already know, we get her snapping out of her sleep, reaching for this gun that she had nearby. The screen cuts to black, and we hear two things. One, we hear her finally cock the gun properly after talking about how she couldn't do it. And so when the chips are down, she knows. And two, we hear him say, "But you've had sex with thousands of men." And then we get the gunshot and her running out of the room. So in this moment, you know, more so than possibly anything I've seen, Lars von Trier kicks us in the nuts and leaves the room while we're writhing in pain. Now, I think like my take on this ending is probably palpable in my voice, but how did this ending work for you?
I loved it.
Okay.
I loved it because it's very von Trier. It's just, I didn't necessarily see it coming, but when I did, I was like, that movie to me, volume one and volume two, the whole thing together, I cannot imagine it ending any other way. Because he's not going to give you an easy out. He very rarely does in his movies. Have you seen Dogville?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, my God, okay. Yes.
So, I mean, he doesn't, and that's a very, very extreme case, but I know, and again, the ending of Nymphomaniac has been getting a lot of, it's really polarizing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I don't know. I liked, again, enjoyed is not the best word to use for this movie, but I got what he was doing. And I said, okay, that makes sense to me. In the world of this movie and in the world of Lars von Trier's very warped mind, it made sense to me and it worked.
Yeah.
So that's all I could say.
Oh, I bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. Like, again, I made me think about the way that we were listening and he was listening and we were getting off.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't enough that we got called out on this, that, you know, we had to pay. And specifically, he had to pay because he thought, for just a moment, he thought that everything that he had just been told was a complete picture of who this person was and not just one big piece among several big pieces of who she was. And again, we go back to the way the movie began, where we have to close our eyes and just listen. You know, it's the complete polar opposite of that serene opening with the water. It's you know, it's violent, it's rough. We can figure out in our heads exactly what she's done, and we have to listen to his half-assed excuse.
What a bad, oh my God, it was just,
man.
But I mean, great, what a great line though for character, because it's exactly what he would say.
It was.
And the whole going to black thing again, so it, you know, it, I mean, not a very hidden parallel, but you know, started in black and now it's ending, and I love that. I loved coming full circle back to it. I thought it was great.
Yeah. So, you know, and like we've talked about these movies for quite a bit. Why should somebody endure these two things either together or even 3 weeks apart? Like, why, I guess what I'm asking in not so many words is, why should somebody watch a 4-hour dirty movie?
I mean, great question. I think you have to be, I've thought a lot about this. I would love to know, we'll never know this, but how many people watch Nymphomaniac without seeing or knowing anything about Lars von Trier? Seeing none of his other movies, and just went into it, because I don't think, I would venture to say that almost no one did that, right? So like, you know what you're getting yourself into with this to some degree. I would hope so. So who should see it or why? I mean, if you're a fan of his, go for it, like do it. But I don't have any personal friends that I would recommend this movie to. Because
really?
I know, I mean, my personal friends, not my online or digital
not
friends.
Not your movie friends, okay.
Right, which are far more, they're far more, you know, advanced in terms of what they like in movies. You know, my personal friends, they appreciate movies, but I wouldn't be able to in good conscience say, yeah, go spend 4 hours doing this on Saturday or whatever night. You're not, I just don't think they would dig it.
The only answer I can come up with is the same reason why I watch a movie like Eastern Promises on a day where I'm feeling sick. It'll make you feel better about yourself.
Well, there you go. That's
you,
a good,
you will watch this movie and no matter no matter how you treat other people or how twisted you think your sexual, you know, preferences are, you'll feel better.
Yep.
That's my thought.
You will?
Yeah.
Definitely will.
Well, once again, you get to pick a souvenir. So this time around, what would be your souvenir for Volume 2?
It would be, it's kind of a variation on the first one, but that notion of expect the unexpected or don't even expect anything. Because if you can watch a movie, even though Volume 2 didn't do it as much for me, if you can watch a movie and not know where it's going or where it's headed, and you know as much about movies as like we do, I'm not trying to sound elitist, I'm not trying to do that at all. You know, like we love movies, like this is our life, right? So I have a pretty good idea if I sit down for whatever, a comic book movie or a romantic comedy or even a Western, where it's going to go. I mean, that's just kind of, I've seen enough of these to know, you know, you have a general picture. But if someone tells me that I can watch a movie and their only recommendation is that you have no idea where this thing's going to take you, then I'm sold. So that would be my souvenir.
Okay.
Whether or not you liked Nymphomaniac Volume 1 or Volume 2, try to find some appreciation in that, that at least it's new, for lack of a better term.
No, good call. Like, you know, we're in a time where a lot of movies are prepackaged and a lot of movies are based on something else that you already know. The amount of times that you get to sit down and watch something where you've got no friggin' clue what's coming, that's something to be applauded. Even, you know, even if you've already been listening to us talk about this movie for an hour, you know, I would assume that it's after you already didn't know what was coming. And if you knew what was coming in this movie, then my hat's off to you, because you are a smarter and more in tune person than I am, that's for damn sure.
Yeah,
well, my
same
souvenir
here.
For this, my souvenir is a scene again. And my souvenir, it comes up in the chapter called The Dangerous Men. And we didn't really talk about this in the scope of the plot, but one of the things that was put out there, like there, you know, in advance of this movie, there were posters and there were still photos that were making their way around the internet. And one of the still photos had Charlotte Gainsbourg, obviously, like, again, mid-coitus, with two black guys. And, you know, your brain probably went to a few different places about what exactly is going on in this scene. I guarantee you that your brain did not go to the right place that this scene actually plays. And I was completely guilty of that. So when this scene actually plays out and we see what is actually happening in this still picture that I've been looking at for months, that to me was just a really huge surprise in a movie full of huge surprises.
And that's ingenious marketing on, I mean, yeah,
yep.
I loved it because it was a total... No one, we're kind of making the same point here. It's just no one knew that that's where that scene was going to go.
Yeah.
Based on that picture. There's no way.
No.
And it was so, I guess that was a rather funny scene too. You know, I'm trying to think of the humor in Volume 2 was much, it was more sparse than Volume 1. But that was a good, I had a laugh at
it's
that.
About all we get, really. You know,
right,
after they leave, it's all downhill from there.
Yeah.
So. All right, well, we rate on a scale of 1 to 4 stars here on the Matinee Cast, and as I mentioned, we are rating this as a complete work. It was originally shot as a complete work and originally shown as a complete 5.5-hour uncut piece. Stop snickering about my use of the word uncut piece. So we're going to rate it as one film. So, Alex Witherow, what do you give Nymphomaniac on a scale of 1 to 4?
I would give it a 3, a solid 3.
Okay, so wait, what holds it back? Is it again, it's that disconnect with Volume 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah. Because I want to, you know, respect your, I don't want to break them down into separate ones, but I would do a 3,
okay.
Yeah.
For me, and maybe this comes down to the difference of sitting with this for 4 hours, this is a 4 for me. This is an unbelievable film-going experience. And gets, you know, while it may on paper be only like a 3.5, if I were to actually, like, you know, do a tally and a scorecard, it gets that extra half mark for just pure audacity. Like I said, it's not, we live in an age where a lot of this stuff is way more prevalent than it would have been even 10 years ago. You know, where, as I said, you can see a picture like the picture you see of Gainsbourg with the two dudes and just make the leap, right? Like, it's everywhere now. You really can't avoid it. But the fact that that was transposed into a feature film, even an art house feature film, to the tune of 4 hours and a bit is pretty damn audacious, and it really takes you to a lot of places, not really all that titillating in, you know, amongst them, which is kind of crazy for 4.5 hours about sex. I can't see somebody watching this movie and getting their rocks off. And
no way.
That's pretty damn impressive.
First of all, I love that. I love that you gave it a four. And I just wanted to touch on two things real quick. You know, you get one shot at seeing a movie for the first time, and I do regret, I would have loved, I didn't have a chance. I live in LA, but I don't believe any theater, actually I know for a fact, no theater was playing them both in the theater at the same time. So the way you got to do it would be my ideal way. Mm-hmm. And I do think I would have liked it more had I seen them the way you did. But, you know,
it's still luck, all good. Really, because you know what? Yeah. Like you live in one of the greatest movie going cities in the world, and if you didn't have it near you, then that, you know, that says something about how few places this is happening. So
right.
I count myself massively, massively lucky, and it really did paint my entire experience with the film. So we're not going to do an other side for this movie. What we are going to do is we're just going to take a few minutes and kind of rap about some movies that a person could go on to. We might as well just get the elephant out of the room to start with. Let's talk about Shane and why somebody could just, you know, if we haven't already talked about it enough, why would somebody jump from this movie to Shame?
You know, it was funny because I was going to avoid that one on purpose in this section. I had two rules.
Now.
I was going to avoid, yeah, I was going to avoid that and all of Von Trier's previous films because I think those would make a good accompaniment. You know, you could watch it in tandem with those two. So with Shame, I think a lot of people might think it's like the nymphomaniac. If you assume that Nymphomaniac is the female Shame, then baby, you're wrong. So don't, you know, you can't go in there like that. But then there's obvious parallel of sex addiction, okay, but just breaking it down a little more, Shame is kind of like, what is it, an hour and 50 minute long version of The Mirror in a lot of ways, of that chapter, in my opinion.
Yep.
So there's no, you never see him enjoying it. I mean, maybe a little in that hotel room with the blonde. I mean, you know, but he's not a guy who's doing this for satisfaction. He's doing it because he has to. And so I would say if you liked those very solemn and bleak moments of isolation in Nymphomaniac, then Shame would be for you.
Well, you know, like the thing that makes me, you know, we brought this up during the review, but part of me wants to, like, I actually want to rewatch Shame now and think in my head how I'm taking all of these reactions and decisions and choices differently from a male protagonist to a female protagonist.
Yeah, it's a great exercise just in terms of being a human being and being a fan of cinema. Yeah.
Did you have another one?
I actually had two. I had The Night Porter. Have you seen this?
No, what's that?
So The Night Porter is, it's about a concentration camp survivor meeting, and this is years after the Holocaust, meets up with her kind of by chance, her Nazi tormentor, you know, years later, and they rekindle their sadomasochistic groove, as it were, because it started during the Holocaust and now they just pick it back up again. And it's a very obviously different kind of film, but Charlotte Rampling is the star and she's great in it. It's a tough film. Like when I saw Antichrist, I was like, The Night Porter's where my head went right away. So,
oh, okay. You know what? I know the poster for this because the cover,
right.
It's the one, there's a criterion of this that's got a really, really striking image on its
and
cover.
And she's like, she's nude, she's topless, but she's covering herself.
Yeah. And there's like the top corner of a swastika in the background.
Right. Exactly. Okay. That's it.
Okay. I might have to bump this one up the queue now.
Yeah. I wouldn't even say I wouldn't go so far as to even call the movie great, but I love it. I love that it was made by a woman in 1974, I believe.
Yep.
So it's just a different, it fits very well in the realm of Nymphomaniac. And then I did have one more, which, speaking of realm, is a film called In the Realm of the Senses, which is kind of about a hotel owner and his employee engaging in this very experimental, enthusiastic, dangerous sex. And like Nymphomaniac, it has unsimulated sex, so these actors are really going for it, and they're leaving very little to the imagination. The actors, the name stars in Nymphomaniac weren't doing that, but he had, I mean, you know that, right? Like, he had filmed porn stars and kind of digitally replaced them.
Yeah, there's some sleight of hand going on, although, you know, we didn't really talk about it much, but there were some moments that really threw me, as in, again, I can't believe I'm nowhere near my laptop, surrounded by other people, seeing what I'm seeing, and I'm thinking specifically of, there's two blowjobs, and they're almost bookends of the movie. There's one early on, and there's one really late, and in both cases, it looks like she's going for it. Yep. I don't know if she actually is or not. She might be. There is some sleight of hand going on where Von Trier used some porn actors and then like digitally threw in the faces. So I don't know if that's what's happening or if they're using prosthetics or what. But it, like, both moments, those were the one. Like, forget about the moments where they're actually shtuppin', and forget about the nudity and the close up shots of both, you know, the male and female parts. That was not throwing me one lick. It was actually seeing that intense fellatio that was really throwing me off.
Yeah, they, and talk about going for it. I know I've read a lot of interviews that, you know, with those two actresses, and they were not doing it. I don't know how it was achieved, if it was prosthetics or if they digitally inserted other
but it's arresting.
It was definitely, it was very arresting.
My other one is one that was brought up much earlier in the show, two Nymphomaniacs ago. My other one is Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which I kind of found, like, the thing I like about it is that it's kind of the anti-Nymphomaniac in the way that there's not very much that we actually see. I think is there even a scene?
No. That's like the whole point of the movie.
There's not even an actual scene of sex. There's precious little nudity, if any, but it's a lot of talk, and it keys in on the way that James Spader's character, a very spry James Spader in this movie, watch this in an episode of The Blacklist back to back and it'll blow your brain. but the way it zeroes in on the way that him listening to stories and getting women to recount their experiences, even just factually, like he it's not like he's trying to get them to tart up their stories or anything. He just wants their honest and detailed recounts, how that's the only way that he can get off. And
right.
I feel as though that, you know, there was a bit of that in terms of the audience, and certainly in the character of Seligma in Nymphomaniac, and that whole idea that some people get their twist by listening, whether it's something that they would do or wouldn't do, or it's the only thing that they have the stones to do. I think it's a really interesting approach to sex that you don't see in movies very often. Listening. That's my choice. If somebody wanted some further reading after 4 hours of Nymphomaniac, these are some movies that you can go to. And I do thank you, Alex, because actually, Night Porter is one that I will go on to, because it's one I've, as I said, even just on that poster alone, I've always been curious about it. So now that I'm still in the, and I use this term loosely, afterglow of Nymphomaniac, I think it's time that I go on to that one.
I know we're running a little long. I'm just curious, are you a fan of Lars von Trier, just of his films?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because my exposure with him is actually kind of limited. I believe he's Breaking the Waves, right?
Yeah.
I believe Breaking the Waves is going to be one of my blind spots this year. I will say this. So theatrically, I saw Melancholia 2 years ago. My introduction to him, if you can believe this shit, was Dogville.
Whew.
Yeah.
At
the Toronto International Film Festival, the year that it was released, that was diving into the deep end. That's for damn sure.
Jesus.
I've told this story before. You know how those intertitles come up, those chapter cards?
Yeah.
And there's one, and the last one that comes up of, I believe it's A Certain Visitor Comes to Town and the Film Ends.
And the film ends, yeah.
That got a round of applause.
I believe it. Oh my God.
Yeah, massive walkouts in that movie. But I was, you know, it was one like I came away from it. I was like, I don't know if I liked that, but that was certainly interesting.
Yeah.
So Melancholia and Dogville are the only two that I, and now Nymphomaniac are the only three of his that I've seen. Dancer in the Dark is going to be a blind spot selection for me later on this year.
Well, I can't wait to hear what you think about that. Breaking the Waves and Dancer in the Dark are my two favorites of his, but they're very, you know, they're Von Trier films, so about as many people like him as hate him, but they're good.
Yeah, I like, in my opinion. The one thing I say about the man's work is I don't know if I'd ever throw it on for shits and giggles, but Lord knows I get a lot from them every time I do watch one of these movies. So I'm interested, if nothing else.
Yeah, and then just one final. I would love to hear what you have to say about Breaking the Waves and Antichrist, because if you've seen those, there are two very, very obvious parallels to those movies and Nymphomaniac, which I won't reveal. I mean, just not even philosophical, just like equal kind of plot points. So I would love to hear your connection.
Oh, well, I'll take on that request, and I'll make sure I write something. I'll watch them close together, and I'll make sure I write something about the two of them combined.
Yeah. And you'll get it. Like, they're not hidden. Like, you'll get the connection. Oh, yeah. Goody.
All right. Well, that is episode 110 of the Matinee Cast. Alex's writing can be found on at soitbeginsfilms.com. Where does the name come from, by the way, since I have you here?
You know, it's like an old family motto. My family and I used to throw that around just kind of when something was like kicking up. But it's also, and so then I kind of adapted it. I mean, that's like years ago, kind of adapted it to. To me, there's no greater feeling than sitting down in a theater, those lights go down, screen comes up, and it's like, and so it begins.
I will never read that the same way again. Thank you. Yeah. That brings a great deal of clarity. Do you have anything coming up next week that people can look forward to?
I do. I have, I do this in-character piece. Yep. Like, I cover different. So I'm going to cover someone that has gotten, I'm not going to say who, but it's gotten a great deal of requests, like the most ever.
Okay.
So I'm going to finally fulfill the needs of my lovely, lovely readers and
nice.
write about that. I'm excited.
And where can people find you on Twitter?
At Shifting Persona.
Very good.
Yeah.
My site, of course, is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Stitcher Radio, apps like Blueberry or Apple's podcasting app. There's also a Google podcasting app in the Android store. Of course, you can also download shows out of the iTunes store. Everything is free, and there's all kinds of ways to get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Nymphomaniac, Volume 1, Volume 2, or any of those other films that we mentioned as further reading can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, or, of course, Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Dude, any final thoughts before I let you go and swelter and with no air conditioning tonight?
No, it turned on.
Nice.
So I had power again.
It's a Christmas miracle.
Yep. No, just thanks for having me on. I had a blast. It was great.
My pleasure, sir. For Alex, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.